This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Slate GabFest Reads. I'm John Dickerson. We are talking today about new Cold Wars, China's rise, Russia's invasion, and America's struggle to defend the West. And the author is David Sanger, who is the White House and National Security Correspondent for the New York Times, best-selling author of previous books, The Inheritance, Confront and Conceal, The Perfect Weapon, also on three Pulitzer Prize-winning teams, and someone I spent a long time covering various White Houses with. David, it's great to be with you.
John, great to be back with you.
I have thoroughly enjoyed this book. It seems like it comes out at the perfect time, and we'll get to why I think it's perfect. But let's go back in history a little bit. I want to start, if we could, with the period before the China and Russia we think of today. Give us a sense of how the Washington consensus, what it looked like, let's say during the Clinton administration, what their view of things were, and how they got things wrong, and was it blindness or was it kind of an honest mistake of misreading events as they were unfolding?
It's so great to be back with an old friend. We've traveled the world together, so you were in for many of the early moments of the reporting in this book. And if you don't mind, I'd like to go back even a little earlier than the Clinton administration, because the consensus formed really after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And all of a sudden, we were in a situation where not only was America the great unipower, but that there was an assumption that China and Russia, each for different reasons, would sign up to an American-led order, or at least a Western-defined order, and that it was overwhelmingly in their economic interest to go do so. For China, a rising economy, but still one that nobody really regarded as a significant threat. You'll remember before my Washington days, I was in Japan for 6 years, and it was Japan that was supposed to be eating our lunch, not the Chinese, right? And the Russians, because they were broke, their government had collapsed, their empire had shattered, and the one thing they had going was oil and gas exports. And no one thought that anybody in Russia would threaten that, no matter how authoritarian they may be. And it looked like there was a real democracy moment. There's a moment in the book, John, in the opening, with George W. Bush and Laura Bush in 2002, floating down the Neva River in St. Petersburg. It was a spectacular night. I was there in the pool on the boat in the back. We weren't eating as well, John, but they had caviar and, you know, everything. You could hear the sound of, you know, Russian music and so forth. It was really terrific. And as they floated down, the conversation on the boat, as I reconstructed it from people who were there, Condoleezza Rice, others of the Bush aides who were there, was all about Russia joining the European Union and maybe ultimately joining NATO. For a number of years, there was something called the NATO-Russia Council, which gave Russia an office inside NATO headquarters. And they were supposed to coordinate activities, you know, on the way to thinking about how they could cooperate with, if not join. There is now, by the way, a NATO-Ukraine council. The Russians are long gone. So the concept was that even under Vladimir Putin, they would come together. And that began to shatter in 2007 when Putin showed up at the Munich Security Conference and declared there are parts of Russia that have been separated by the collapse of the Soviet Union, and they must be reunified. And Bob Gates stood up and said, this sounds like an old Cold War, you know, revival. I've been through the old Cold War. I don't need to go through another. 7 years later, Putin takes Crimea. Does the U.S. get the message? No. The West waits for a year to impose sanctions. Then they're ineffective. And the next year, 2015, Angela Merkel signs the Nord Stream gas pipeline deal and says the Russians are a reliable supplier. So why would the Russians come to any other conclusion other than that if they tried to take Ukraine, all would be well? They just put up with some issues from us and it would go away.
Was this, David, as these signals were coming up, was this willful blindness based on the belief that economic coexistence and economic ties would be predominant over all the old forces of history, plus the idea that democracies or the flow of democracy would solve a lot of ills? Was it too much belief in those two things, or was it just generally a distaste for and dislike of the kinds of hard choices you would have to make if you really wanted to confront Russia for going into Crimea or Georgia, that just people lost the appetite for the kind of hard things you have to do to confront these emerging threats?
I think it was three things, John. I think it was bad intelligence, wishful thinking, and, as you say, an aversion to what confrontation would mean. Bad intelligence is that the U.S. intelligence indications were essentially that Russia would follow its economic interests. They weren't all consistent that way, but that was the overwhelming element of the consensus. The wishful thinking part was that democracy was indeed sort of the final state of governance. The Francis Fukuyama end of history essays were still being, you know, circulated around, and it was it seemed like a reasonable thought at the time. I was with Bill Clinton on a couple of trips to China. And on one of them, he ends up at Beijing University, Beida, and gives this great speech to the students that basically says, the internet will set you free. It will erode the control of the Communist Party. They will, over time, recognize that the Chinese people are now in interactions with the rest of the world, and they will sign up to it. And look, I believed this stuff as I was listening to Clinton. As it turns out, the Chinese Communist Party figured out how to make the internet and digital technologies in general an exquisite method for social control, right down to the facial recognition that they use to pick out every dissident walking down the street, right, or across a train platform. So we had that one wrong. And then finally, there was conflict avoidance. During the Obama administration, you may remember, because I think we talked about it some the time on CBS, that the Russians and the Chinese were doing extensive cyber attacks into the United States, right? The Russians got into the White House, the State Department emails, the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The Chinese stole 22 million security files on Americans who hold security clearances, right? The Obama administration didn't want to name Russia or China in either one of those cases because it could set up a confrontation and raise the question, well, then what do you do about it?
I wonder, just super brief detour here into Havana syndrome. You know, there's been 60 Minutes and other 60 Minutes has reported that the Russians were, the GSU was behind Havana syndrome. And there's some speculation that the U.S. government is saying, no, they weren't, for just the reason you cited, which is once you name them, oh my God, now what do you do about it? And that presents you with a whole bunch of really ugly choices.
Could be. And I saw the 60 Minutes report, and it was the most comprehensive, you know, review of the evidence and the backup material for it that I have read. I think the Biden administration at this point, this deep into the war with Ukraine, no longer has an interest in avoiding blaming the Russians for much. So I'm a little more skeptical of that now. I think the turn came when the U.S. sided with Ukraine. And, you know, we are in everything but direct American to Russian conflict now there each day.
Let me add one more question about the past before we move on to the future. Place the ongoing conflicts in the Middle East, you know, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and the distraction of that in the context of these missed signals, you know, whether it's wishful thinking, bad intelligence, or conflict aversion. How did the distraction of the war on terror, as it used to be called, play into this?
It was a very central player. First of all, the national security strategy of the United States from the Bush era post 9/11 on was that terrorism was the number one threat to the United States. I think if you wrote those words today, people would look at you as if you had just arrived from Mars, right? But that was, for 15 years, the primary U.S. national security strategy. And this is not a party thing. That was true during the Bush administration. It was true during the Obama administration. And the first national security strategy that actually reversed that was Donald Trump's. It was actually written about a year into his presidency, and I go through the writing of that national security strategy, which was driven by his National Security Council staff at the time. But the fact of the matter is that Trump himself probably never read it, certainly never absorbed it. And the day that the national security strategy comes out, with this intention to turn the entire bureaucracy of the United States, but particularly the Pentagon and the intelligence agencies, to focus on the revival of superpower challengers, China and Russia, which it refers to as revisionist powers, right? The whole concept here, written by H.R. McMaster, who was for a year until Trump got tired of him, national security advisor, that was the message of the document. Trump goes out into the Rose Garden, announces his new national security strategy, and starts talking about terrorism, because everybody understands terrorism easily.
I got to jump on that McMaster point. You tell it so well, as you do so many turns in this book, right? Great analysis comes through stories. And so you tell the story of H.R. McMaster creating this document. And I guess it takes is a nice bridge for us. What does McMaster see? And then can you combine in your answer to that and his vision for a great power rivalry in the world? Talk a little bit about what it's like to try to change thinking within an administration. Donald Trump is a particular cat, right? He's
right.
A particular kind of person. But as people think about the presidency, you know, lots of things get said by the candidates on the campaign trail, but you know better than anybody in the world where this stuff really takes place. And it's the people like H.R. McMaster and Bill Burns at the CIA and State Department. Can you just introduce us a little bit to the way ideas are floated and the way national security thinking changes, not because of who the president is, but because of the people who work for them?
Sure. So this, again, was a bipartisan thing. Look, 9/11 was a huge shock, and we ended up reorienting the CIA toward counterterrorism, built up a big physical counterterrorist operation, you know, looked a lot like special forces, right? The Pentagon shifts entirely there. And you got to a point and you got a generation of rising leaders in the Pentagon, the future members of the Joint Chiefs, the high ends of the admirals and generals there, who basically all had to serve in the war on terror if they were going to get promoted. And you had to be, you know, at the State Department, there was a requirement if you were a young Foreign Service officer, in part because they were having a hard time staffing it, you had to spend time in Iraq or Afghanistan, you know, if you had hopes of rising. These were the big issues of the day. And so what do you get from that? You get a lot of expertise in that area. These are bright, hardworking people. They're thinking about counterterrorism each and every day. They're thinking about that region of the world each and every day. And, you know, in an earlier book I did, much earlier, my first book, this one's my fourth, you'd think I would have learned by now, but called The Inheritance, I went to the Central Party School in Beijing, and I was having lunch with a just-retired Chinese Air Force general who said, you know, of all the meetings we sat in about dealing with the United States and trying to keep your huge military at bay, no one ever raised the possibility that you would spend 15 years distracted in the Middle East, running around against some relatively lowly equipped terrorists while we built up to a military to Russian and beyond levels so that we could actually take you on. Because, you know, the fact of the matter is, while it's nice to say you can do counterterrorism and also build up the Indo-Pacific and all that, the political attention was not on the Pacific.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu.
It's hard to imagine a world where we leave future generations with fewer rights and freedoms. The Supreme Court has stolen the constitutional right to control our bodies. Now politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the essential sexual and reproductive care they need, including abortion. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves access to care. It's a human right. We won't give up and we won't back down. Help ensure the next generation can decide their own futures. Donate to Planned Parenthood. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than their worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. Ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Currents issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members of FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Do you think it was avoidable, some of these mistakes, or is the system and the way we make policy just incapable of, and you did that explanation of promotion through the Middle East is such a great point because it shows the way in which the system orients thinking down a certain avenue. Did you learn in looking back at all of this about ways, habits of mind, kinds of thinkers, you refer to George Kennan and others, who actually did see this stuff coming, who were trying to say, hey, let's not lose focus on this particular thing. And because what I'm looking for here is what kind of habits of mind we want to have now with the challenges that come for America in the next 40 years ahead.
Well, first, because the Berlin Wall had fallen, the Soviet Union had dissolved, as a nation, I think we came to a sort of an unspoken conclusion that the era of superpower conflict was not only over, but it was over permanently. And we took every time that we worked together with the Russians or the Chinese on a project of common interest as reinforcement of that thought. And we did do some good work with them. Well, let's think of the list here. Obama struck New START, limitation on nuclear weapons with Putin. The Chinese and the Russians were on the U.S. and European side of the table in negotiating the 2015 nuclear agreement to restrain Iran and keep it from getting a nuclear weapon. In fact, the Russians took their nuclear material at some profit, but took their nuclear, 97% of their nuclear material, put it on Russian territory to reprocess it so it wouldn't be in the hands of the Iranians. That's a significant contribution. We did a climate agreement. Obama did a climate agreement with Xi Jinping. Wasn't everything. There was a lot of battling back and forth. But at the end of the day, the world's two largest emitters came to some common understanding. None of that seems within reach now, a mere 7 or 8 years later. The second thing I think that happened is that a generation of Americans who grew up learning in school and in college a bit about the Cold War, about nuclear deterrence, about the range of ways that large powers compete around the world, sometimes with proxy forces, much of that went out the door. You know, there were not a lot of courses left in nuclear studies because the thought was, who needs nuclear weapons, right? There wasn't a lot of Russian language study. There has been a fair bit of Chinese language study, but really only in the past 10 or 15 years as people thought about the commercial opportunities of going into China. There was a lot of Japanese studies when I was Tokyo bureau chief for the Times in the late 80s and early 90s when we thought that Japan was going to be our biggest competitor. I think I've mentioned to you before, I think the biggest sign of this is if you listen to the Kennedy-Nixon debates from 1960, and you forget for a minute the question of whether Nixon looked like he was sweating and Kennedy looked, you know, youthful and vigorous and all that, and just listen to the topic matter, it is a detailed discussion of how we ought to organize our military for deterrence of the then Soviet Union. And that level of strategic discussion is almost impossible to imagine 64 years later in a presidential campaign on either side. This is not a partisan issue.
And it's both the level of detail, and this continues on. The 1984 Democratic debates are all about deterring the Russians.
That's right.
You know, and with Gary Hart and Al Gore, I mean, deep detailed. So it's both the level of detail. And then also, I remember in one of the Kennedy debates, I think it was a primary debate, and basically on a whole range of national security positions where the moderator tried to get Kennedy to criticize the sitting president Eisenhower, Kennedy said basically, not going to do it. National security is too important to mess with politics. What I wonder, based on the point you just made, though, is when you look at the way campaigns are covered, and we've got one going on now, and then you think of your career talking to the people who carry out what presidents do on the national stage, what distance is there between the way we talk about the job of the presidency and the way you've witnessed it through the many administrations you've covered or the many national security practitioners that you've covered who obviously all work for administrations?
So there's a big distance and a widening one, because you could have big international crises going on. I would say the Mideast right now is an exception to what I'm about to go describe. And along the way, you would have presidents who are spending much of their day on it and not talking about it very much. There's a scene in New Cold Wars from October of 2022, when President Biden is in the living room of James Murdoch, the Democratic black sheep member of the Murdoch family. It's a fundraiser. Everyone's like walking around with glasses of wine, looking at Murdoch's very impressive art collection up on his walls in his apartment in New York. Biden comes in to this crowd and he says, looks around and he says, you know, for the first time since the Cuban Missile Crisis, which happened to have been 60 years before that week, we have a direct threat of the use of a nuclear weapon if, in fact, things continue down the path they're going. Now, what he didn't tell them was that he had been looking at intelligence for the past couple of weeks of intercepts of the Russian commanders who are responsible for tactical battlefield nuclear weapons. And they were discussing rolling one out and where they would attack a Ukrainian base. And for a brief period of time, the Biden administration thought there was a 50-50 chance that the Russians would use a nuclear weapon against Ukraine at a moment, October of 2022, when the Russians were doing really poorly on the field. But what didn't happen? There was no John F. Kennedy-like Cuban Missile Crisis speech from the Oval Office declaring that Putin should back off, right? This only came up because Biden mentioned it, and I went back and I saw the transcript, and I go back to the National Security Staff, and it's like, yeah, it's exactly what he's been saying in the Oval Office for the past couple of days, Cuban Missile Crisis all over again. I think most Americans were completely blissfully unaware.
Which then leads me to this question, which is the Biden team came into office with a whole lot of experience. And, you know, Bill Burns, who's the current director of the CIA, bumps up in the book all over the place in his various roles. I mean, or at least there's references to his various roles when he was in Moscow, serving in Moscow. What's your assessment of, because part of the argument you're making is that there was some calcified thinking, as you say, it was part of both parties. But wisdom and experience are crucial because Bill Burns knows Putin
better than any American in high office.
Exactly. And so give me the sense of the Biden team and that mix of what's necessary to have the wisdom of the past, but also the adaptability of the present.
The wisdom of the past is definitely there then in this group. And it's a very tight team. They talk mostly to each other, which can, of course, be a downside. But the combination of Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, Bill Burns at CIA, who is a CIA director, but is used by Biden for a variety of other purposes, including trying to negotiate the hostage agreement and ceasefire in the Middle East from his time there. I mean, I've never seen a CIA director who takes on this range of tasks, and who knows Putin really well and is sent to talk to Putin before the war breaks out and to warn him of how the U.S. would react. And by the way, in the book, you will read Bill Burns describing those meetings with Putin at a level of detail I don't think you have ever seen before, in particularly from a CIA director. But so it's a very well-oiled machine that early in the administration had a real near-death experience, which was screwing up the withdrawal from Afghanistan. And I argue in the book that the concept of getting out of Afghanistan was right. It was actually one of the few things that Biden and Trump agreed on in the last election, that the U.S. had to get out. The execution of it was miserable. And the fact that it was so miserable actually shook the team up, I think, and put them in a better position to do Ukraine right. And they did the run-up to the Ukraine war pretty brilliantly, releasing the intelligence in advance to embarrass Putin into, you know, the admission, basically, or the revelation that he really was getting ready to invade. He did this, Biden did this with the allies. He did it with all of us, you know, so that we were able to go publish some of this stuff. We were able to confirm some of it through open source. That was pretty well done. The invasion happened anyway. He brought NATO together in a way that we did not expect. And for a while, the Russians were on the run. The problem is Ukrainians didn't win fast enough. And now we are seeing the full mass of the Russian military come back.
In thinking about Afghanistan, what was the central mistake that the Biden team made?
I think it was this. The president made the decision in April, 4 months after inauguration, to pull out of Afghanistan. They then had a number of months to actually execute it. During that time, they did not have a plan in place to get everyone who had helped the U.S. military, news organizations, their families out of the country. Very few left. And they were working on a faulty assumption that the Taliban were not going to make their way into the capital, Kabul, for another year or year and a half, when in fact, of course, the Afghan military collapsed and the Taliban were there by August. So they made a wrong assumption about how long the Afghan military would be able to hold off the Taliban. And they made a wrong assumption about how much time they had to get people out of the country. And when that collapsed, everything turned to chaos. And I remember on around the July 4th holiday in 2021, I was pool with the president, and he was making at the White House some economic announcement. And the night before, the military had pulled out of Bagram Air Base, this huge base that had been the center of all activity, because they didn't want the Taliban to be able to take the base fully loaded up. But they didn't tell anybody, including the Afghans, that they were leaving. So suddenly, one day, they're gone. And I asked the president about this, and isn't he worried that this is going to lead to a chaotic withdrawal? And he said, no, there's no problem here. We have, you know, over the horizon intelligence that's really good. We can come back in. We've got this all under control. You can look at the transcript of this answer. 6 weeks later, the country's in full collapse.
That answer echoes, as I recall, the argument he was making within the Obama administration about how they could withdraw from Afghanistan even back then, when the president decided, President Obama decided to go another way.
And by the way, I have no problem with the idea of withdrawing from Afghanistan. I do not think it was a sustainable thing to do. But having made the decision, you wanted to have a completely well-oiled machine here. And, you know, it's interesting, as copies of this book have begun to recirculate, and I thought, well, this is the chapter that's going to, you know, really raise hackles, and maybe it will. But since I finished that part of the book, the Inspector General's reports have come out, you know, with fundamentally some differences, a similar interpretation. So, you know, I don't feel like this is exactly original or alone interpretation of events.
Let me ask you about cyber, which you've spent so much time educating us all about. What you write about here is not only great power competition and the state of it right now, but it's not just that these are familiar countries. But it's a new kind of warfare. It's both, as you say, it's got a little World War I thrown in, a little Cold War nuclear bristling, and then cyber, which is a whole new kettle of fish. How should people think about, and they can read the book for all of the details, which starts at the very beginning before the Ukrainian invasion, but how should they think about cyber warfare in the current basket of national security threats?
Well, John, the last book I wrote was The Perfect Weapon, which was just about the rise of cyber conflict. And part of its argument was that cyber is a terrific short of war weapon because it's hard for countries to figure out how they're going to respond to it. We don't want to go to general war because your companies have been cyber attacked or because there's been an information operation to try to manipulate an election. What we've learned in Ukraine is how cyber is useful in a war that is underway. And what we've discovered is that there are some things for which it's extremely useful and some things for which it's not useful at all, pretty much what I argued in the previous. So if you're going to take out a power plant in Ukraine and you're already at war, why go to all the trouble of trying to have these coders get in and try to disable it when you can put a missile through the substation and just blow it to smithereens? It's faster and cheaper. So once you're in a general war, there are some things that are still much more efficient to do the old-fashioned way, which is to say, blow it up, right? But we've also seen the Russians, and it's harder to detect and harder to see on TV, that they have done coordinated kinetic attacks on power grids, government organizations, satellite systems, whatever, and cyber attacks that mesh in with those so that both are underway at one time. And one of the things that the U.S. military is doing right now, it's quite wise, and NATO is doing, is they are beginning to take lessons learned from the Ukraine war in case we are in a conflict with a superpower. So here's a really good example. At the opening of the war, Microsoft and Amazon World Systems came in and in a week moved all of the operations of the Ukraine government to the cloud because everything was sitting on servers around Kyiv and elsewhere. And their point was, as soon as somebody puts a missile through those servers, you're done with veterans payments, medical payments, tax revenues, you know, whatever. That was brilliant. What had nobody planned for? How you would communicate with the cloud. And the only one that saved that at the last minute was Elon Musk by putting Starlink there. Okay. So one of the lessons now is you would never go into a conflict of this kind without having survivable communications with a system like Starlink that's got lots of different satellites. Nobody was really thinking about this in an organized fashion about conflict until Ukraine happened.
I feel like in the range of cyber, Christopher Wray is warning about China in U.S. infrastructure. It feels like every other day. I'm reminded of George Tenet, the director of the CIA, who said, you know, I think was it that he said his hair was on fire pre-9/11 about Al-Qaeda. Am I misreading Christopher Wray at the FBI? He feels like he's like hair on fire about China and U.S. infrastructure.
It's not just Christopher Wray. Starting last summer, we were running stories in the Times about a Chinese operation that has been named here Volt Typhoon. And the warnings have come from the National Security Agency, from Britain's equivalent of it, GCHQ, from the FBI, from the Department of Homeland Security, which runs the computer and infrastructure, you know, divisions. What Volt Typhoon is the implantation in America's power grids, water systems, other critical infrastructure, code that the Chinese have put in place that could, if activated, take this stuff offline, not permanently, but just long enough to cause chaos inside U.S. society, for just long enough to distract us at a moment that the Chinese were, say, attempting to take Taiwan. A lot of this has happened in utilities around major military bases in Guam, in Hawaii, in California. And those bases rely on each one of those outside public utilities for their water and their electricity. So the idea might simply be slow down a U.S. response. The Chinese are following the footsteps of the Russians, who put something similar in a number of years ago, and the U.S. made it public. The cyber community believes that they've done a good job of getting out and sort of informing everybody of this. And, you know, the utilities certainly know about it, and their big efforts to try to chase this stuff off the system. What I don't think they've done as well is inform the U.S. public that this is underway, because they're afraid of panic. But instead, I think what they need to do is to say, look, the Chinese have done this. We've seen it. Here's the backup plan if this goes out. Here's how you're going to get water in your community on those military bases. Here's the resilience we built into the system. And that's how you bring a whole country together in a combined defense plan and make it a lot harder for the Chinese to think about actually executing that plan. And it's because no president wants to stand up and admit that your critical infrastructure has been infiltrated by the Chinese or the Russians.
Right, especially not in an election year. As we're taping, the U.S. Treasury Secretary Yellen has left Beijing after a series of conversations about the economy and Ukraine and a variety of other things. And as she was leaving, Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, was landing in China. The challenge is not just to the U.S., is not just China and Russia. It's also, in some senses, China and Russia. How do you see those two and their cooperation complicating the national security picture?
John, this is one of the reasons that I've been at work on new Cold Wars for a number of years now, because I think the most fascinating thing happening in international relations now, and the most significant one, and the one least discussed in the presidential campaign, is the coming together of our two major old Cold War rivals, Russia and China. The whole opening to China, as designed by Nixon and Kissinger, was intended to keep this from happening, right? To interfere with what was then a Soviet Union-China relationship in which the Soviets were by far the superior player. Now, of course, it's all reversed. The Chinese hold all the cards here, and Putin recognizes that China's the one ally he needs the most. But the fact of the matter is that trying to come up with a strategy that deals with two superpower rivals at once is the hardest part of this, and it's the core of new Cold Wars. Because while there's familiar stuff about the old Cold War in this, the differences of the era we are in now and that era are much larger than the similarities. The China-Russia connection is one. Second, during the Cold War, we didn't need anything from our major adversary, the Soviet Union. I mean, we bought caviar and vodka, and you and I would not want to live without, you know, either one of those. But if we had to, like, struggle by, we'd make it. Okay. But we are dependent on China, and they are dependent on us for a range of technologies that make this far more complicated. Now, does that mean that China and the United States will never go into a confrontation? If you believe that, then you are signing up to the same logic under which Russia would never invade Ukraine because it would cut off their oil and gas revenues. So there's a huge danger here of assuming that our adversaries are thinking with the same values that we have.
David Sanger, thank you so much. The book is New Cold Wars. It is a great read, and I feel like, David, it's not only a great read to understand foreign policy at this moment, but anybody who cares about the country and this next presidential election should read it, because this is where, as Kennedy used to say, domestic policy can lose us an election, foreign policy can get us killed. And these are all the issues that are the most serious and most dangerous. Thanks again, David.
Thank you, John. It was great fun talking to you again, and it was great fun writing the book.
And that's it for this month's edition of GabFest Reads. Our producer is Shayna Roth. Ben Richman is Senior Director of Operations and Podcast. Alicia Montgomery is Vice President of Audio at Slate. We'll be back next month with another edition of GabFest Reads. Until then, all three of us will be back in your feed on Thursday with a new episode of the Slate Political GabFest.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know there are urgent things happening in the world around you, but all you hear is noise. That's why we made What Next. Our goal is to tell you the stories you haven't heard before, or maybe a different side to the story you thought you already knew all about. I'm Mary Harris, the host of What Next, and I love my job because it helps me cut through the noise of the news. And then I get to bring it to you. Together, we can figure out what next.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.